This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for June 16th, 2014. Last week was certainly an interesting week with a wide variety of decisions, rulings, etc., on which we intend to report. We'll begin with the Chief Counsel Advisory, a ruling that a taxpayer's interest in a partnership does not flow through to the taxpayer. The interest in the partnership, which was a dealer in securities, doesn't make any of the partners dealers in securities. Now, if you had a single member entity, which was a disregarded entity, then you'd get the flow through. But a partnership's activities do not flow through to its partners. Very interesting ruling. And then a decision of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California that online poker accounts are in fact reportable as foreign bank accounts. That would be United States versus Hom. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then a private letter ruling, 2014-23-013, a company's subchapter S election was inadvertently terminated when three trusts, which had been established during the lifetime of the settlor, became ineligible shareholders following the death of the settlor. And this, again, illustrates the importance of monitoring the ownership of S Corporation stock by trusts, which might have been grantor trusts during the lifetime of the grantor, but are not when the grantor dies, and therefore you have to make either an electing small business trust election or a qualified subchapter S trust election. Then we have an electronic communication and emailed advice from the service advising that the fair market value of a cash value life insurance policy in two scenarios is part of a reportable transaction understatement to which the Section 6662A penalty is properly applied against the amount that is included in income. Then, the big news of the week, I suppose, is that the final Circular 230 regs are out. They eliminate the covered opinion rules, so all of those disclaimers on your outgoing emails can now be removed. They never meant anything anyway. Then, Frank J. Blangiardo, in which the tax court holds that an individual whose son, who was an attorney, acted as an intermediary in an intended like-kind exchange, could not treat the transaction as a tax-deferred exchange. The qualified intermediary has to be independent of the taxpayer. And then guidance is revised for practitioners who may be sanctioned under Circular 230. I thought you might be interested in that. I hope that you don't exactly have a personal interest. And then Revenue Ruling 2014-18, non-statutory stock options and stock appreciation rights granted by a non-qualified entity are exempt from Section 457A as long as both the stock rights are exempt from Section 409A, and the stock appreciation right at all times by its terms must be settled and is settled in service recipient stock. That, of course, goes along with some other changes that we've been monitoring with regard to stock options. And then in Robert Seavers, we have the tax court upholding additions to tax for failing to timely file a return and pay the tax, upholding the accuracy-related penalty, determining that the taxpayer had in fact received cancellation of indebtedness income, but allowing a few deductions. It's an interesting potpourri. And then the Supreme Court acted quickly in Brandon Clark versus William Ramaker, unanimously affirming the Seventh Circuit that an inherited IRA is not exempt from a debtor couple's bankruptcy estate because the IRA no longer qualified as retirement funds. It certainly was not a retirement funds of the debtor. It was an inherited IRA. The money cannot be invested in it. You can't add anything to it. Money can be withdrawn regardless of retirement status, and there's no penalty for withdrawal. And finally, one of those alimony decisions where the taxpayer attempts to get an order of a state court modifying alimony to take advantage of federal tax rules, and that doesn't work. That's Adriel Michael Bauer, TC Memo 2014-117. Let's talk first about Chief Counsel Advice 2014-23-019, advising that a taxpayer cannot use partnership activities to claim losses under a mark-to-market rule. The taxpayer is a holding company for a partnership that has a percentage interest in the partnership, although doesn't own the entire interest in the partnership. The partnership engaged in the business of originating and purchasing mortgage loans on the open market, participated in mortgage-backed securitization activities, then contributed the mortgage loans to a disregarded entity trust, and the trust issued notes to third-party investors as mortgage-backed securities. The partnership qualified and used the mark-to-market method under Code Section 475 for its securities and identified a percentage of the mortgage loans as held for investment and did not mark those mortgage loans to market. The question now is, the partnership clearly is qualified to use the mark-to-market rule, but can a partner then take advantage of that partnership transaction? According to this chief counsel advice, then, none of the dealer activities of Partnership X, including customer status with the holders of mortgage loans, are attributable to the taxpayer. Very interesting puzzle, I'm sure, for those that were trying to give tax advice and do the tax compliance, where certain activities of the partnership cannot flow through to a partner because the partner does not have the same status as the partnership. Next, we have John Hom, an online gambler. During 2006, he gambled online through internet accounts with PokerStars.com and PartyPoker.com. He continued to gamble online through his PokerStars account, and throughout the year, both poker websites allowed Mr. Hom to deposit money or make withdrawals. He used his account at FirePay.com, an online financial organization that receives, holds, and pays funds on behalf of its customers, to fund his online PokerStars and Party Poker accounts, depositing money into the FirePay account from a domestic Wells Fargo bank account or perhaps other online financial institutions such as Western Union. In 2006, FirePay stopped allowing U.S. customers to transfer funds from their FirePay accounts to offshore internet gambling sites, so Mr. Hom used Western Union and other online financial institutions to get money out of his Wells Fargo bank account and into his online poker accounts. The IRS audited his returns and assessed penalties for failure to file foreign bank account reports with regard to his FirePay, PokerStars, and Party Poker accounts, assessing $30,000 in penalties for 2006, $10,000 for each of the accounts for which Mr. Hom did not report. The decision here is summary judgment for the government. The court had no trouble determining that those online accounts were in fact foreign bank accounts, the equivalent of foreign bank accounts, and upheld the assessment of $10,000 per year for each failure to report. Next, we have Letter Ruling 2014-23-013, in which a subchapter S election was inadvertently terminated when three trusts became ineligible shareholders, and the IRS, in this ruling, allows the taxpayer to continue to be treated as an S corporation provided qualified subchapter S trust elections are filed for each of the three trusts and all returns that are due are properly filed. These three trusts were wholly owned grantor trusts when they were established, but later the grantor of the three trusts ceased to be treated as the owner of the three trusts. Now, whether in this case the grantor died or there was some change in the terms of the trusts, in any event, those who were responsible for monitoring the S Corporation compliance missed the change in the ownership of the trusts. And once the trusts were no longer grantor trusts, your S Corporation is no longer an S Corporation unless each trust makes an election to be either a qualified subchapter S trust or an electing small business trust. The lesson here is that if we're preparing tax returns for an S corporation or advising an S corporation about its tax affairs, we need to be alert for changes in the status of any trust that owns S corporation stock. Next, we have an electronic communication, an email out of the Chief Counsel's office, advising that the fair market value of a cash value life insurance policy in two illustrated scenarios is part of a reportable transaction understatement, and the Section 6662A penalty is properly applied against the amount that's included in income. That's a pretty straightforward statement, but the reference is back to Notice 2007-83, in which the IRS identified as listed transactions certain trust arrangements that claimed to be welfare benefit funds, but involved cash value life insurance policies where the intent in an abusive arrangement was to maintain a plan for 5 years and then distribute the policies at a time when they were relatively low value. The issue here is that whether you have the penalty for failure to report participation in the transaction or not, any amount that is included in income is going to be subject to the Section 6662A penalty. And now the really big news, final regulations governing practice standards replacing the rigid rules that were in Section 10.35 of Circular 230 with a simple rule requiring that you be competent in all work that you undertake. These regulations are effective June 12, 2014. They adopt, with a few minor changes, the regulations that were proposed back in September of 2012. They modify the rules governing written tax advice, as well as other related provisions of Circular 230 that govern practice before the IRS, and they modify the consequences of failing to meet the practice standards, such as the expedited suspension provisions. First, the final regulations eliminate the complex rules governing covered opinions in the current Section 10.35 and adopt one standard for all written tax advice under Section 10.37. There, the new rule specifies that a practitioner must base all written advice on reasonable factual and legal assumptions, exercise reasonable reliance, consider all relevant facts the practitioner knows or should know, and must use reasonable efforts to identify and ascertain the facts that are relevant to written advice on a federal tax matter. The authorities estimate that the elimination of the collection of information requirements in the covered opinion rules is going to save tax practitioners at least a total of $5.3 million. I think that's probably a little bit light. The final regulations also remove the requirement that practitioners fully describe the relevant facts and the application of the law to the facts in the written advice itself. In response to a number of comments, the final regulations eliminated the use of Circular 230 disclaimers in documents and transmissions. So you can take those Circular 230 disclaimers off your outgoing emails and your outgoing correspondence. Finally, the final regulations define a federal tax matter as any matter concerning the application or interpretation of a revenue provision of the tax code, any provision of law affecting a person's obligations under the Internal Revenue Laws, and any other law or regulation administered by the IRS. And of course, the rule that you must not consider when you're evaluating a federal tax matter, whether it will be audited or not, continues to be part of Circular 230 as well. Frank Blangiardo, Tax Court Memo 2014-110, made a mistake or two with regard to an attempted tax-free exchange. His son acted as intermediary. Now, his son's an attorney. He intended to have a like-kind exchange, and he intended that his basis would be increased by payments he had made to two different ex-wives. First, the payments that were made to the two different ex-wives did not increase his basis in the property. That was pretty simple and straightforward. Second, the question of whether or not his son could act as a qualified intermediary is what I thought was the really significant issue in this decision. The problem the taxpayer had here is that according to Regulation 1.1031K-1G43i, a qualified intermediary must satisfy a number of requirements, and one of those requirements is that the qualified intermediary must not be a disqualified person. The term disqualified person includes an agent of the taxpayer at the time of the transaction, such as the taxpayer's employee, attorney, accountant, investment banker, broker, or real estate agent, within a 2-year period ending on the date of the transfer of the first of the relinquished properties. Further, according to the regulations, persons who bear a relationship described in Section 267B, specifically family members, including ancestors and lineal descendants, are also disqualified persons. So the taxpayer and his attorney son missed an important part of the tax law and the regulations. Your relative cannot be a qualified intermediary. Your employee or anyone who has served as has provided professional services within 2 years on either side of the transaction cannot be a qualified intermediary either. Next, Revenue Ruling 2014-18, addressing non-statutory stock options and stock appreciation rights granted by a non-qualified entity, holding that they're exempt from Section 457A so long as they are exempt from Section 409A as far as being part of a deferred compensation plan, and the stock appreciation right at all times by its terms must be settled and is in fact settled in service recipient stock. We have here a foreign corporation, a non-qualified entity for purposes of Section 457A subparagraph B, grants the stock rights as incentive compensation to a limited liability company that provides services to the foreign corporation. Each right is granted for a fixed number of the foreign corporation's common shares, which qualify as service recipient stock. Each stock right has an exercise price per share that is not less than the fair market value of a common share of the foreign corporation on the date it's granted. The stock rights do not include any feature for the deferral of compensation and otherwise comply with applicable requirements of either Regulation Section 1.409A-1B5, one little I, cap A or B, and the terms at all times provide that the option must be settled in service recipient stock, and the right is in fact settled in service recipient stock. So neither the stock right nor the option granted to the LLC service provider is a non-qualified deferred compensation plan that would be subject to taxation under Code Section 457A. If the plan is not subject to 409 cap A, then it is not subject to tax under Section 457 cap A. Pretty straightforward conclusion. Next, we have Robert Sievers, TC Memo 2014-115. A number of issues: failed to timely filed returns, didn't pay the tax, tax court upheld an accuracy-related penalty. There are several deductions that were disallowed, but I selected the case to talk about because the taxpayer received cancellation of indebtedness income, which was not properly reported. That's the issue I wanted to focus on. Mr. Sievers purchased a truck back in 2005, and he didn't make the payments on the loan. He asserted that the truck was a lemon, and eventually Ford took the vehicle back as a trade-in for a different truck. His version of events was not exactly the same as Ford Motor Company Credit's version of the events. They provided documents eventually regarding the 2005 sale and financing contract. Mr. Sievers made only one timely payment and two late payments between April and November, when the 2005 vehicle was repossessed and then sold at auction in December of 2005. Now that's when Ford took title to the truck. They then sold the vehicle at auction, and that left a remaining balance of $12,000. Now that happened in 2005. A 1099-C was not issued until 2008, when Ford Motor Company, in accordance with the 36-month rule, reported cancellation of indebtedness income. The court recites, and I think it's well, I'm going to read what they wrote: a bookkeeping entry by a creditor does not result in discharge of indebtedness income. So the discharge did not occur in 2005 when the truck was repossessed and sold. It is the issuance of the Form 1099-C, which is an identifiable event, not dispositive of an intent to cancel indebtedness, but we have a rebuttable presumption when an identifiable event occurs in a calendar year if, during the testing period, which is generally 36 months following the origination of the debt, ending at the close of the year, the creditor has received no payments from the debtor. The records here reflect that the last payment Ford Motor Credit Company received from Mr. Sievers was in August of 2005. So the 36-month period ended in 2008. Ford Motor Company issued the 1099-C in 2008, and that's when Mr. Seavers had the income from forgiveness of indebtedness, not in 2005 when they took his truck. And that's really important because the transactions, the disposal of the truck, should have been accounted for on Mr. Seavers' Schedule D or some other form in his return. And the recognition of the income from forgiveness of indebtedness is 3 tax years later. That's the way it works. Briefly, I wanted to update everyone that the Supreme Court has in fact unanimously affirmed the Seventh Circuit, holding that an inherited IRA is not exempt from a debtor couple's bankruptcy estate. The citation is Brandon C. Clark versus William J. Remaker. Remaker is the trustee, and Mr. Clark is a debtor in bankruptcy. The IRA, the inherited IRA, no longer qualifies as retirement funds. You cannot put any more money in it. The money can be withdrawn regardless of retirement status, and there's no penalty for withdrawal. The IRA is simply just another financial account. It does not have the special status of retirement funds. Now, the retirement funds have a special status, and they are protected under the bankruptcy code, but the inherited IRA is no longer retirement funds. That's the issue, and the Supreme Court acted very quickly to affirm the decision of the Seventh Circuit, which we reported in this program, I think, maybe 7 or 8 months ago. Finally, this week, we've got one of those decisions involving an attempt to have a divorce decree modified by an order of the same state court that granted the original divorce in order to change the treatment of alimony for purposes of federal tax. The tax court in Adrio Michael Bauer, TC Memo 2014-117, holds that an individual is not entitled to an alimony deduction and for any greater amount than allowed by the Internal Revenue Service, rejecting a state court order that purported to correct the dissolution judgment regarding alimony, finding that the individual is liable for an accuracy-related penalty on any resulting underpayment above a certain threshold. The alimony, the original alimony award, or the original support award, was undesignated support of $3,500 a month or a close amount, but there was a provision that that amount would be reduced upon an event in the life of a child. When the IRS audited, they obviously, that provision makes the portion of the support that is going to be reduced upon the event in the life of the child, makes that portion non-deductible. So after the IRS audits, the taxpayer goes to the state court to get an order modifying the original order, and of course that's too little too late. Otherwise the IRS would be wasting its time auditing if taxpayers could go to state court and get the terms of a divorce decree that the IRS had already audited modified by the state court. Well, it's a long program this week, a lot of things to talk about, including the Circuit of 230 changes. I encourage everyone, get a copy of the new Circuit of 230 with the changes, read it, make sure you understand it. The change from the responsibilities under Section 10.35 to responsibilities under Section 10.37 is significant, and it's something we all need to make sure that we have in our quality control document, especially the responsibilities of the managers to make sure that everyone in the firm is complying with Circular 230. Well, that's a wrap, and you know the rule. Stay safe.